looks like it's 11 o'clock, so let's get started.
I did.
My grandpa, Gustav de Slover, was born in Belgium in 1881. Now, Belgium had been a small country under many people's domination for centuries. It was kind of, I like to think of it maybe as the hallway that connects all the rooms in the house. So if you wanted to go south to conquer somebody, you went through Belgium. If you wanted to go to north to conquer somebody, you went through Belgium. So it didn't have a very stable life for a long time. But by the time my grandpa was born, it was independent. It had been doing pretty well as far as culture, the arts, religion, and even economically. Welcome. My grandpa, Gustav de Slover, was not very well economically. His family consisted of three boys and one girl. His father had died, and they were really, really poor. So it was decided that somebody should go to America, you know, the land where all you had to do was reach down and pick up the jewels and the gold from the ground, put them in your pocket, and go on home, where he could keep the whole family for the rest of his life with those jewels and that gold. Well, they scrounged around, and among themselves, they got enough money for a ticket for him, the chosen one, to go to America. Now, it's true, it was down in the lower deck there. Didn't smell too good, didn't ride too good, but, well, he had his cards to play cards, and he had his little flask in his pocket, and he also had a very, very staunch stomach, I'm told. At least he used to tell me that when I was a kid, and he'd say, well, anybody who could eat poison ivy sandwiches didn't get sick on a boat ride. Well, it took him about 6 weeks to get here, and when he got here, he landed in New York and had really nobody he knew. He played with cards with people on the boat, but he didn't have anybody to meet him here. He didn't have English, or maybe a couple words, didn't have money, and didn't have any way to get any food. He knew he could work once he got going, but he had to get going. And then he saw a policeman over in the corner, he said, and he went over to this policeman and kind of grabbed a hold of his coattails and was trying to tell him, he wanted food, and he wanted a place to sleep. So this policeman grabbed him, took him across the street to a jail, opened the door, opened the cell door, motioned to him to go in. What kind of place is this, America? The first time you're here, they put you in jail? Well, my grandpa wasn't one to worry about those things. I mean, the bed looked good, didn't have any vermin in it like it did on the ship, and he wasn't going to give up that bed just because it was in a jail cell. So he lay down and fell asleep. When he woke up, there was some food right next to him. So he hurried up and ate it. He didn't know what was going on, but he wasn't going to waste that food either, and went back to sleep again. Well, the next morning, there was another policeman there, and he motions to my grandpa to come out of the cell, and there's some more food right by the policeman's desk. I want to get out of the jail cell. He's telling me to come on over. So he kind of jiggled the bars, and the door opened. It had never been locked. So he went out and ate, and the man gave him a little bit of money. He didn't know how much it was. He says, I don't know what it was. It was paper. That's all I knew. So he took the paper, put it in his pocket, and then he got his little flask back. But the guy was telling him something in English. He wasn't sure what it was, but he kind of shook it like, get rid of that stuff. Well, he did. He went out behind the jail, and he got rid of it and went on to see the United States. He went north, he went south, he went east, he went west, he went all over. Oh, he worked on farms, he worked on railroads, He rode the railroads, not exactly in luxury, and he saw the United States. Wherever he went, he tried to find some De Slovers, or at least some Belgians. But he didn't find any De Slovers and found very few Belgians till he got to Croswell, Michigan. It had been about 10 years, he said. He got to Croswell, Michigan. By this time, he's about 29 years old. And he got to Croswell, Michigan, and there were tons of Belgians all working in the sugar beet fields. Well, he met up with this one man. His name was Louis Vergoven. Louis was an older man, had a bunch of kids, but his wife had died, and an older daughter was taking care of the younger children. And every night, my grandpa would go over and play cards with Louis Vergoven and some of the other Belgian men. And this one older daughter would serve them food and drink in the evening, but they didn't talk very much. And then one day, it says in the archives of our family that Louis Vergoven calls his daughter Lizzie over, Elizabeth Vergoven, and says, "Lizzie, this is," just forgot my grandfather's name, "this is Gustav De Slover, and you're going to marry him." Now, my grandma always said that she hadn't talked to him very much. She didn't know if she liked him, but you didn't go against your father. We grandkids sometimes wondered if he had lost or won the card game. They fought like cats and dogs, but they ended up having 9 living children, so they must have made up pretty well. Well, they ended up living in Monroe, Michigan, in the southern part of Michigan, after they had lived in Norway, Michigan, and Croswell, and Sullivan, Indiana, and different places. They ended up in Monroe. I have literally hundreds of relatives in Monroe, Michigan. My grandpa never got back to Belgium. We have an argument about whether any of his brothers ever came to America. Some say yes, some say no. I'm beginning to think it was yes, but not for long, because he didn't like it here. But you know, if you go to the Monroe telephone directory, there's a page or so of De Slovers. As I said, there were 9 children in my mother's family. I have, 48? I keep losing count. 48 cousins, first cousins in that family. They have children. Their children have children. You know, if you count all the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, the great-great, there's even a few great-great-greats, I'd say he got pretty wealthy. At least if you count wealth in your blood and family. And so my grandpa came to get rich in America, and maybe he did. Now, what kind of story is that?
Family story.
A family story. Now, it's not a family story that I, as I'm going to ask you to do later, just picked up and in 5 minutes told. I'm still changing it. Because I was looking, for instance, today, or last week, and I was looking for a book that my dad wrote called Grandfather Remembers. Now, I gave it to him to write. My father did not just pick it up and say, "I want to write this for my daughter." My father was a difficult man sometimes. But I learned so much from what he wrote. In fact, I wish I would have read it more carefully before he died. My father was not an easy man to get along with. He was an alcoholic at the end that was very difficult to get along with. Our daughter had made it her goal when she was a teenager to get Grandpa to say, "I love you." Nobody'd ever heard him say it. And so every time we were on the phone, she'd say, "I love you, Grandpa." Nothing. And then the next time, "I love you, Grandpa." Mm. "I love you, Grandpa." Mm. I mean, this took months until one day he said, "I love you too." Now, he didn't say it too freely after that, but that was her goal and she achieved it. So I wasn't quite sure sometimes if he loved me. And then last week when I was reading his book, I noticed, which is what I had noticed in the beginning when I got it after he died, that he had nothing in there about my childhood, because there's a section where you remember what you did with your child and all that, and what your teenager did and what you shared. There was nothing in there. And I thought, well, what kind of love is that? And then I read the other parts again, where he wrote about his teenage years, the fact that he was so pleased that his father would go fishing with him. His father, all of his relatives had died very young, like in their early 60s, from heart problems. And his father had to retire when he was in his early 60s also to take care of my grandmother, who was crippled. And he was so pleased that he could go fishing with his father. And he wrote about things that his father did that pleased him and made him loving. And he wrote about how much he wanted to go to high school. He had a straight A average until his mother made him take typing and shorthand because she thought everybody should know that. And he absolutely refused to do anything in there and flunked it. Other than that, he had all A's for 4 years of high school. But he couldn't go to college, even though he was offered scholarships, because he had to get to work. They needed money. But his goal in there was to become an engineer. And when I was a child, I was born in 41, and when I was a child, he worked 7 days a week, at least 12 hours a day, as a tool and die maker. And yet, I remember that he made the most intricate kitchen cabinet and dresser for me, and wood workbench for my brother, that were exact replicas of the real things, because he did everything exact. Also, when he did this, he kept telling us later that it was made out of orange crates because there was no wood during the war. And sure enough, when I stripped it for our daughter, it was the orange crates. I could still read the names on there. And then my mother was telling me the story of how he would work 12 hours a day, then he'd come home, and he would get the items he was working on from the attic, because nobody went up there, it wasn't finished. He'd bring them down to the basement so nobody could hear him pounding and work on it for an hour or so, then bring them back up to the attic until they were finished and Santa Claus could bring them to the house. Well, you know, there's other things with it, but the point is, for all those years when I was a child, there was nothing to put in because he didn't see me and he didn't know me. And then during high school and older childhood, he was working on that ICS course and he did become an engineer. So what's the point of it? These stories help us know things we never knew. They help us learn that love can be said in more than one way. I still don't have a lot of good memories of part of those years, but I know he loved in his own way. So those are some of the things. And I'm going to go home and work on this because my daughter gave me this. Grandmother remembers. And the first few pages are quite full. And then I got busy with other things. But I'm thinking that maybe the best busy is to get this book finished. Now, it doesn't have to be in a book like this. It could be the stories you tell to your family, young children, older children, to your nephews, to your grandchildren, to whomever. I have to be a little careful. Every so often I'll say something in my grade. My youngest usually now, the oldest one is kind enough to be quiet, but the youngest will say, we've heard that story before, Grandma. That's good you told it to me. So, what we did yesterday, if you weren't here, is we talked about, well, first of all, who came to visit us? Who was the character that came to visit us at the beginning of class? What story did I tell?
He was.
No. I like to do first-person stories, but the Bible is much lacking in women compared to men. And there are some, and I tell them, but sometimes to get to the men, I have to be a woman, because I'm not comfortable, although I have some friends who tell stories in the first person of males, and they're female, but I'm not comfortable that way. So I was Noah's wife. And I told the story as I was cleaning up the ship about what happened and the relationship God and Noah had and all this stuff. And then I finally had to leave and go see about this rainbow and the worship and all that and hoped that the rabbits would stop reproducing and the mosquitoes, they couldn't figure out why on earth God had him on the ship in the first place. So that's one kind of story, a first-person story, a biblical story. A lot of our stories are third-person. Now, when it's first-person, what's a plus about that? What's good about doing a first-person story?
You really get into the role of it.
Yeah, they come alive. You can think about how you might feel, and maybe that isn't the way Noah's wife felt. But as a woman, there's certain universal things. I'm sure she had to clean up the ship a little bit and wasn't happy, you know, and all the work. And so you can put some of those feelings in, get into the head. Of course, the negative part is you don't know what happened next. I was doing Katie Luther last year, and I couldn't tell him when she died. I mean, I was alive. So you can only go so far with first person. Third person is what? What would you do if you had third person? What's some pluses and minuses?
You cover a lot of things that the first person wouldn't have known.
That's right. You can fit it in history afterward.
Right.
What were you going to say?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's kind of a plus there. You can carry it, broaden it out a little bit. You can tell what other people thought about it. You can lose your electricity. Well, it doesn't hurt us too much, but it sure hurts the PowerPoint people. Well, I don't know what to do, so I'll just let it go. Somebody will fix it. Yeah. Oh, dear, I should be telling you it's not my problem right now. Yes. When you have a situation, you should remember the story, it's not my problem. It seems there was this king, and there was his advisor, and they were sitting in the palace, overlooking the square, eating some honey on biscuits. And as they were eating, the day grew warmer, and they were looking out to see what was going on in their kingdom and talking about this and that, nothing in particular. And as they were talking, they sort of didn't notice what was happening to the honey on their biscuits. And it started dripping down the side of the building. Well, as it dripped down the side of the building, it got down, they were only on the first floor, but it's kind of big in this castle. And they got down there, and some of the honey dripped right on the ground. And out darted a little gecko from the hole that he lived in near the bottom of the castle wall. And the gecko grabbed some of that honey and started eating it. And the king, or rather the advisor, said, "Oh, we've got to clean off this honey. We've got to get somebody to clean it off because it's all going to drip down and make a big mess and we'll get all those geckos out." "Oh, don't worry about it," said the king. "It's not our problem." See, it gets solved. "It's not our problem. We'll just keep on talking." And so they did. But you know, pretty soon, there was a cat over there. And the cat saw the gecko diligently eating of that honey. And the cat leaped on the gecko. And the gecko managed to slip away, but the cat was chasing him. And the advisor said, "Oh, sir, we've got to call somebody to separate that. The cat and the gecko, you know." But before the king could even say anything, a dog came and started chasing the cat. And the advisor got extremely agitated and said, "Oh, sir, we must do something. We've got to stop this." "Oh, it's not our problem. It'll stop. Somebody else can stop it." And so they did nothing. Well, after a while, the owner of the cat and the owner of the dog, they saw that what was happening, and each one thought their animal was getting the best or worst of the deal, and they started getting in there, and then they started yelling and shouting and fighting. Oh, the advisor said, "Oh, sir, we've got to stop this. They're going to hurt each other." "Oh, it's not our problem. Somebody else will take care of it." Well, pretty soon some soldiers came along. Some soldiers liked the cats, and so they helped the cat people. And some soldiers liked the dogs, so they helped the dog people. And pretty soon there was a big fight coming along. And of course, you know what happened. The advisor said we should get somebody to help, and the king said it wasn't their problem. And then somebody got hurt, and then somebody got killed, and then a fire started, and then the king and the advisor were standing outside looking at the fire in the castle and looking at the civil war that was going on around them. And the king said, "Well, I guess it was our problem after all." So, you know, if you're doing a Bible study, for instance, or whatever, and you're talking about responsibility, or you're talking about the little boy who helps Jesus feed 5,000 people by sharing his fish, or whatever. Some of those stories are good to know, too. They're not very long, but they can get in there and get going. So, Bible stories we sort of did yesterday. That was after we looked at the who, what, why, when, and where we tell stories. So, this is up here. I did add today, which I had forgotten last night, one thing that most people think about sometimes when they're doing stories or thinking about it is that public speaking is an adult's greatest fear. So as a storyteller, that's one fear that most everybody has to get over. Not everybody. There's people who thoroughly enjoy it, like me. But it's not always easy. And every time you go before a new group, whether it's your Sunday school class, whether it's the Bible class, whether it's a daycare center, whether it's the Narnia kids, you're always thinking, are they going to like what we're doing? Is it going to flop? Is it something, you know, can I really make them interested in this? But you get into the story, and you're not telling it. The story is telling itself, so it's okay. I also added, we talk about the greatest teacher. And this greatest teacher used all kinds of stories in his teaching. And who is this greatest teacher?
Jesus.
Yeah, so how can we say stories don't belong? Nobody does, of course. And then I also, under the when, I added lawyers. I have a friend who, one of her gigs is to teach lawyers how to tell stories. Because what is the summation? What is a trial? But telling stories and trying to convince people that your story is the true story. So stories can be manipulative also. But anyways, that's what we were talking about yesterday, and then we went on and took some objects and told stories. It was fascinating because, obviously, as I said, we only had a few minutes, so it probably would develop into something else, although a couple of people had some that I think were totally finished. I had in mind that we were going to be doing Bible stories, but we had a gaggle of cats, and some people did Bible stories, and some people did family stories, and some people just did a crazy story, and it was wonderful. So stories can be anything. Now, looking at these family stories, we've already had one, and then I wanted to take a look before we do our others. I mentioned on your list about Dinah. And who does Dinah go with? That's one of the characters I like. Who's Dinah go with? Actually, it should be on your bibliography, not bibliography, your agenda. Didn't you get one? Get one of each of those, or two of each if you want it. Who's Dinah? Who does she go with? This is one of my first person ones, so who would she be telling about? She's not a very well-known character in the Bible, is she? I think she's older New Testament. I may have put who she goes with on there.
I always thought Dinah.
Oh, well, maybe that's the problem. All right, who's Dinah?
Maybe Dinah is correct.
I don't know. So who should she go with? She's Joseph's half-sister. Dinah's the, Dinah. She is the only girl in that terrific family of 12 brothers. And she is the daughter of Leah. And so Dinah tells the story of her bratty brother Joseph and all the things he did and how he paraded around in his pretty robes and that and had dreams where father and mother were bowing down and all this. Didn't do too well with the family at first. And so the brothers decided to get rid of him. And then they ended up he ended up in Egypt. And eventually the whole family did because they had the famine and they were a little concerned about what he was going to do when he found out who was there asking for help. And it's a long carried out story and it can go long or short, whichever. But you can use that with classes. You can use that with a sermon. I did it one time as a sermon, but I got it too long. They were kind, people were kind, but I thought, oh my goodness, I sat there and listened to all that. I should have chopped it a little sooner. But so Dinah and Joseph, that's how I can tell the Joseph story in first person. Another one is Miriam. Who's Miriam go with?
Moses.
Yeah. So Miriam and Moses. And how, what would be the advantage of telling it as first person instead of third? And Miriam could tell it as a first person. You could tell it as a third. There's nothing wrong with that.
She could tell what her brother was really like.
Yeah. Except actually mine doesn't, because she doesn't know much about it, because he was in the palace. But she does know that she's the one that brought him down to the river and can tell about his beginning till he went on to the palace and was raised by the Pharaoh's daughter. And she went with him to the river, to the sea, and she danced. She did the dance and all that for the great joy. I never think of Moses talking about that. Maybe I'm totally wrong. But I think the joy that Miriam brings to that story is important. How about the mother, and this is stretching, and I will confess, a boy who had fishes and bread. Our vacation Bible school this year had, as one of their stories, the boy who had the fish and the feeding of the 5,000. And so I was just going to tell the story, but the person that asked me said, well, why don't you be the mother, the proud mother of the boy who shared his food? I said, well, that's stretching a little bit. It doesn't say much about that in the Bible, but I did it anyway. And because I think, again, it wasn't taking away from it, but it was getting them the way we humans would probably have acted if we were a mother. He's sharing that food. Now, that's a story that we have so little knowledge of, and we go for the what does it mean part, and we don't quite go for do we have all the facts. So I feel like I can put some extra things in there, and as long as I'm kind of following what the kids would anticipate. And so that's another one we could do. Of course, Mary and Martha, you can either do a team or you can do it where you take turns being Mary and Martha. And there's a lot of stories about that. And that way we can get into Lazarus and what Jesus did. Another one is I don't know if any of you have ever heard the Adam and Eve diaries. I think the first time I ever heard them was here at Holden Village. And there was a husband and wife who did it. And then I found out it was Mark Twain. He wrote the Adam and Eve diaries. Now, they did it a slightly different from Mark Twain, but that's okay, too. Mark's dead. But when they did it, it seems that Adam just didn't understand this new creature that had been placed into his vicinity. And he's writing his diary about it, that she talks. She's always talk, and asking questions. And she's always bothering him, and he just wants to be there quiet. And in the meantime, Eve is writing her diary, and she's talking about this thing they call man. And he never says anything. How are you supposed to know what he's thinking? And it goes back and forth and back and forth. And the two people who did it at Holden Village were absolutely delightful. So I went home and found it. And to this day, it's been 20 years, I haven't figured out how to present that, because I don't do tandem telling with two people like a lot of people do. And if I had to, he won't tandem tell with me. But it's a fantastic story. So go home and look up Mark Twain and the diary of Adam and Eve's diary, or diary of Adam and Eve, I can't remember which it is. But it's in a lot of the larger collections. So that's another way you can present something like that. Maybe at an adult social function or something. Could be a lot of discussions. So there's a lot of things that you can do with stories from the Bible. And you know what? A lot of Bible stories are really family stories. A lot of these are family stories. And so today, for the rest of the time, we want to look at family stories. And we're going to do this. I've already told you about that. I've told you about my father, and I've told you about the book. But I also want you to think about what you would do. Where did I put my paper? Here we go. This is a set of questions. Now, you can take up to 3 and reject 2, but let's not go through all of them, okay? We'll pass this around, and what I want you to do is take one of these out, and if we have time, we might take another one. We'll see, because there's something else I want to do. And I'll give you a few minutes to think about it, but I want you to either answer the question, or they're not all questions. Sometimes it's just tell about the, or something like that. And I want you to take something out of here, think about it. Remember, this is not a, you don't have to worry about it being a half hour complete story, but a snippet that you might want to grow and develop later too. And I will be giving you a list of everything that's in here, and you can think of others that aren't in here. Okay, questions?
So you want me to take 1 or 3?
No, I'm just saying, if you don't like the first one, you can take a second or a third, but let's not go through all of them. You gotta find one sooner. Questions? Find your slip, look at it, think about how you could answer that. Be as truthful as you'd like. Remember, I don't think I told this class that. I was telling somebody, one of the kids that, I guess, at Tartan Narnia. With family stories, some of us started too late asking the questions. That's why I say, fill your books in, write a journal, tell your kids. There's so many things I forgot to answer or ask my parents, my grandparents. And I'm the older generation now. There's nobody to ask. So what do you do if you're an archaeologist and you get a pot and you've put it all together and it looks lovely except there's 3 parts missing? Well, you find a piece and fit it in. Usually I think they're white and the pot is a different color, so you know which ones they had to fit in. So I do that with family stories. I may not know exactly what it is, but I can fit in from other people's stories, fit in from other things in history. My mother wrote her memoirs up till the time I was born, then they stopped. I guess she got too busy. And she had quite a life as a child. Well, she had 7 brothers. 3 of them also wrote their memoirs. And I have copies of all 4 of them. And after my mother died, I was with the next family reunion. We're in our 60-something Vergovan family reunion right now. And I had read all these, and I said to my uncles, did you guys all live in the same family? I mean, according to my mother, her brothers came in from the farm work, put their feet on the table, and waited to be served. According to my uncles, it wasn't like that. They worked hard. And my mother, being only the only girl for 12 years, with, it would have been about 6 other kids, and all boys, she was spoiled. And they would have gotten kicked across the kitchen, literally, if they'd have said what my mother could say to her father. Well, my mother totally disagreed with that. So they're not going to be exactly the same, but that's okay. Somewhere in there is the truth. Maybe you get all your brothers and sisters to tell the same story and see what happens. Okay. Gotta finish your row. Don't mess up your hat. Please. I showed the group this last night. I don't know if I showed them this. I just told them. This is the Biblical Storyteller, and there is an association of Bible storytellers or Biblical storytellers. I just joined it. I don't always agree with it. Because you see, they believe on their objective sheet that you do everything from memory. You say it exactly according, let's see, do they use RSV or NRSV? I forget. But you do not deviate. That's what they have written. But in this magazine, this one right here, they have several interviews with several people. And they're not always doing it that way. I have been to one or two of their conferences, and they were excellent. And even the ones where they were memorizing it were excellent, because they were just so into the story. But I didn't join for a long time because I don't tell that way. I'm not good at memorizing. I don't like to. I feel like I'm in a bind. But at the same time, maybe they're getting a little freer too. I don't know. The other group I belong to is the National Storytelling Network, and this is a storytelling group in general. And this is the storytelling magazine that comes out every 2 months, isn't it? Yeah, every 2 months. And some of you may have heard of Jonesboro, Tennessee. I don't know. That is a big storytelling festival. It's the first weekend in October, and there are thousands of people there. And I think it's 6 different gigantic tents. So those are other things you can do as storytelling. Are we ready? Who's first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
My question is, who in your church as a child made an impression on you? Little background, I'm an amateur violinist. Not too bad.
Good. We know him. He's good.
A number of years ago, two little twins who were just starting Suzuki were going to play for a Sunday school program for the first time. And one of them had a 1/8 size violin, and the other had a 1/4 size violin. And they came and asked me to tune their violins for them. Now, one was in third grade, and the other was in kindergarten, I think. The third grader clearly had the musical gene, and so she and I have developed a relationship over the years based on a common interest in music, and I've been able to mentor her a bit, not only in music, but in a few other things as well. And just this week, she's going off to college, and it's been a great experience for me and for her, and I think I've been able to help her along the way in several ways, and I'm hoping to keep in contact with her as she goes off to college. She's a gal whose mother and father are separated, and I don't think she's ever had a good father image, and I've tried to do a little bit along the lines of helping out that. So that's my little story.
Good, and I'm glad you started with that, because I forgot to mention that family doesn't have to be genetic. We have a lot of different family members. We have a care group at church. We belong to Noah's family, because every time we went camping for the last 30-some years, it has rained and rained and rained. So we survive. We're Noah's family. Who's next? We can go around the room, or somebody can raise their hand.
I'll go next.
Okay.
I actually, when you talked about your father not knowing if your father loved you,
mm-hmm.
I think that that's a particular drawback of most men's lives, at least up till my generation, because mothers were at home, fathers were at work, and so that relationship of a father with their children takes a long time to develop. And like your father, my father worked long hours. He owned his own business, and so was often at the office. And like your daughter calling and saying, I love you, right? Well, I would call the office and say I wanted to speak to my dad. Well, one day I called and I said, this is Al's darling daughter calling. And the interesting thing was, it was almost like the tables had been turned all of a sudden. He was so proud of the fact that I had pronounced our relationship as the very loving and emotional mm-hmm. relationship to the world. And he would always then, from there on out, whenever I stopped by the office or whenever I came to the office, oh, that's my darling daughter, you know. And so it was like it made it okay or acceptable for him to express that love publicly, mm-hmm. you know. So it was very interesting, I think, when you talk about the relationship, it allows you to put it out for acceptance. Mm-hmm. So,
but it's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, for years I did not talk about
my
father.
Well, that's what I mean. That was his business world.
Yeah.
You know? He didn't talk about family. It was all work and business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but as a high school student, you needed brides and money and whatever. You know, there were times that I had to contact him while he was at work, and not often, you know, but anyways, in fact, it was so rare, I usually had to tell him who I was if I was calling, so anyways, but yeah, it made it okay.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Next.
Well, mine is, tell something unique or what you learned, or that you learned on your first job. My first paying job came about when I was, I don't even know, probably less than 10. We had eggs delivered to our house from a local farm, and the woman that ran the farm, her name was Miss Bayer. I found out later that she was of the famous Bayer aspirin family, and that was her fortune, that she had this farm in our neighborhood. She delivered fresh eggs to us, but she also had strawberries, and she needed pickers for her strawberries, and she was looking at our family, because I had a big, hefty older brother who was only 13 months older than me, and she was thinking he might make a good picker for the strawberries. And so I remember her talking to my mother about getting my brother to be a strawberry picker, and I'm going, well, why can't I do it? And she looks at me, and I was always small for my age, especially compared to him, because he was very big for his age. You know, well, then there's this discussion, well, you're not old enough, you're too small, you're blah, 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 and I'm thinking, but I want to do it. It's, you know, and she had said how much she would pay, and it sounded like a lot of money. It was like $20, you know, for you could earn in a week. And I'm thinking, well, I've never had money before. This sounds great. And I wanted to do it. And then she finally told my mother, okay, well, we'll give her a try. And so, you know, first day came, and my brother and I rode our bikes over to the farm. And she set us down with our, you know, our crates and the rows, and actually, being small was quite an advantage for picking strawberries. You're closer to the ground.
Yeah.
And I was really good with my hands and quick. And, you know, I had my crate filled in about, you know, before even, I mean, she had, in addition to kids picking, she had some professional pickers out there too. And I would even beat the professional pickers. She didn't believe that crate was my crate.
I had to prove it.
I had to prove it, but by the end of the week, you know, and she kept track of all the crates that you picked and at the end of the week, the money. And what I learned from that is, you know, size doesn't matter, age really doesn't matter. It's how well you do the job.
And if you use that story with your children, grandchildren, or whatever, and just said, you know, age doesn't make any difference. It's just what you do. I mean, they go, pshoo, pshoo. But they're going to remember a story like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens a lot of time, that you remember things that are embedded in a story. Are you two together?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that story?
No, I really don't know this person.
Did you know that story?
I'm trying to recall. We've been together 40 plus years.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering. You looked like it was a little bit of a surprise when you heard this.
I'm not sure that you may have referred to that story. We've talked about it.
Yeah. people we thought we knew really, really well, too, through stories. Are you
stories
ready?
Help us remember what we may have been told before.
There you go, yes. are you next, then?
I'm next, but I looked through all those, couldn't find it, and then I said, okay, I'll just pick one. So, tell a memory about a member of your extended family. I've been just drawing blanks here, but my grandmother was quite memorable. Bright, I'm not sure it's about her as a person. Long auburn hair that was always braided up in a crown was the most memorable part of her that I recall. And then city lot in Portland, chickens for eggs, and dahlias growing in probably a quarter of the lot, and they were taller than I was as a kid, and the dahlias were different size, every color that there was, and just going to grandma's house spend a week there each summer. I have two brothers, and each of us would spend a week there. And want to earn some money? Okay, sure. We'll go downstairs and find the walnuts uncracked. And here's the end for each bit of walnuts. We would make so many pennies, which we could then get to go and buy one toy when we go across the street at the supermarket.
It's a scrapbook. You've got a scrapbook started.
Right. Those are some real strong memories.
Yeah. And sometimes you start with that scrapbook, and then you start remembering more about one part of it,
sure.
and that grows and develops, and it can do all kinds of things. Several years back, well, quite a few now, we had a midweek program at church, and one of the things we did is we had a lot of grandparents whose grandchildren lived away from Columbus, and then we had a lot of grandchildren whose grandparents lived away. And so we had secret grandparents, and the kids knew. They drew names. We got all the people over some age, I forget. Probably would make it a lot younger now. But we had these, the kids drew names, and they knew who their grandparents were, and we pointed them out in the church directory and in the pictures, and gave them a little background in that, and then every, I don't know, it was once a month, we started out, we would do it in the class, and they would make a picture, write a poem, write a letter, do something, and put it in the grandparents' mailbox. And then they were on their own if they wanted to do others, and some did a lot, and some didn't. Then the grandparents, we had a special grandchild mailbox, and the grandparents, I believe they put their name on the letter, and then we would pass it to the child who got it. And that went on for the year, and then we had a big dinner party at the end and revealed who they were. Some of them dropped it, you know, right away, but some of them carried it on. This was third, fourth, fifth, sixth maybe. Some of them carried it on all through high school and developed a very, very good relationship. And part of that relationship was based on story, because the information we gave to the grandparents was to tell your grandchild that you don't know about yourself. And so they did some of these things. And so they really knew something about this grandparent they had, and then the same thing with the grandchild telling what they did at school. And some of them guess because they, you know, I play the violin or something. But so that's another thing you can do, and it's kind of story based. Are you ready?
Well, my mother is speaking to you all, and I never did get that car that I wanted. You know, growing up in eastern Montana on a homestead, and Daddy had this old car, and it seemed like every time we went someplace, there was a flat tire. And I just decided that when I was old enough, I was going to have a Cadillac, and I was going to have four spare tires, so I would never have to have this deal of having to be left in the road and having to get your tire fixed, and it was just really a pain. But, you know, I never did get that car. And when I left home, I sure certainly didn't have enough money to buy a car. And so I always had to kind of beg for rides or take the bus. And even when I got married, well, goodness, the war was going on, and scrimping and saving to get a car. And, you know, my husband just drove that. You know, he had to get to work, and I was staying home taking care of the kids, so I didn't get to. I had learned to drive. I was sure I could be able to drive just fine, but I never got the chance to. And then, before you knew it, my kids were learning to drive, and they were the ones that were driving. So we got an extra car. But that was most of the kids driving, you know. I hardly ever got a chance to drive. But then when I got older and the kids were gone and my husband got, he wasn't so well and he didn't do all that driving. And I got a car. And so I was the one that was able to drive the car around. What kind of a make was that? You know, I'm not any good at remembering. It was a red car, and it was a Plymouth, and I don't remember what model or anything it was. But I drove that thing, and I kept driving it and driving it. I never did get a new car, and that one only had one spare tire, but then I didn't have the problems that Daddy used to have with all his cars, and the tires going bad. So, and by that time, my son was the one that was looking after it and making sure that it ran, and if there was a flat tire, he changed it, so I didn't even have to worry about those flat tires that I used to worry about so much when I was a teenager.
Super. First person does bring it alive, doesn't it?
That, in case you can't figure it out, what was your first car and how'd you get it?
Okay, super.
Well, I have some memories about my first job. Since I grew up on a farm, all my work was on the farm. And I realized looking back from looking back several years to when I was a kid that my dad had a plan for introducing me to the working life on a farm. And about fifth grade, I began doing that. We had one of the things was to grind corn for the feed hogs. And so first it was my job to load the wagon with corn. And there was corn overhead in the crib, and I would rake corn down and cover in the wagon and fill it. And then that was all I was asked to do at first. Then I learned how to do that pretty well. I had to back the wagon and up to the barn where we had a hammer mill. And the hammer mill was such that it had a place to scoop corn in. It would be shoot about a couple feet wide and 3 or 4 feet long, and fill that. And it would run down to the hammer mill. And the hammer mill consisted of a wheel inside which had hammers on it, and ingate out. And so it could get into the, get stand in the wagon and scoop the rest of the corn out into the hammer mill. Eventually, I got so I opened the ingate and I could lift it up. I'd get it out. I could do the whole thing. It was a noisy operation. I figured out that I better put cotton in my ears. But it was loud enough that we have to yell face to face to understand one another. So, after a year or two doing that, I got to feel pretty comfortable doing that. And it just very natural, came pretty natural. I had a sense of accomplishment that I knew how to do something. Then I had the power of the hammer mill. We would set a tractor near, and had a power takeoff, and that would be a wheel on the side of the tractor, which would be about this big in diameter, and to run a belt from hip up to the hammer mill, back, and to position the tractor just right. Well, it takes a little while. Moving it back and forth, up and back. You put it on, you didn't have it lined up just right, it'll come off. So the pulley on the tractor had to be exactly parallel to the pulley on the hammer mill. And I'll learn how to do that. Yeah, so I do. Actually, I think I could do the whole operation, except I didn't back the wagon up the hill to the barn. Backing a wagon takes a little more.
So we need to really maybe work on our own stories with our own friends and family. I want to do one thing. I have four sentences, and you may have one of the four to say one word on. When I was a kid, most Sundays we, you maybe use two or three if you want. On my birthday, I always. My mother made lots of things to eat, and my favorite was our family listened to blank on the radio or watched blank on the TV. Now, yeah, just one or two or three words. That's all you need to say. Which sentence would you like? I'll repeat
sorry,
it.
Sorry, I guess.
Yeah. You were out. You left. Huh? That's okay.
Am I answering everyone? Or
no, no, just one.
Oh, okay.
When I was a kid, on my birthday, my mother made things to eat. Our family listened or watched. It's like a game.
How about on my birthday?
On my birthday, I always.
Oh, I eat either angel food cake or cherry pie because my birthday is at the end of January, and so you know, with President's Day coming up, there's usually cherry pie.
All right.
Both favorites of mine.
Which one would you like?
On Sundays, we always have company for dinner.
Okay. What's yours?
On Sundays, my mother always took my brothers and myself to church,
okay.
Followed by roast beef dinner.
Oh, yeah. That was ours, too. Yes?
On Saturdays, our family always listened to Dark Shadows.
Oh, yeah.
Or The Shadow.
The Shadow.
The Shadow. Yeah.
Only the Shadow knows.
Yeah.
Which one do you like? When I was a kid, on my birthday, my mother made, our family listened to.
I was going to say, on Saturday afternoon,
okay.
We'd find a chicken that was getting plump, meaning it wasn't laying, and wring its neck and pluck it, we'd have it for dinner the next day.
Okay.
Dick? That's graphic.
Yeah. He didn't chop it, so he just plucked it.
Blackberry pie. My favorite.
Oh, well, they're my favorite from your mother's. Okay. So sometimes just, if you had, and I don't have those on the back of, oops, this. But, I'll write them on here for, if you're able to come back tomorrow. And then you can add those, or make up your own, actually. You don't need to pass them all on.
And I forget what time I'm doing this. Tomorrow we're going to take a look at fairy tales and folk tales.
What's this for, Joyce?
This is what's in the envelope. Just in case you'd ever want to use this with family, at a family reunion, at church, wherever. This is what was in there, in the envelope, if you didn't get through all of them.
That's right.
Okay. So, yeah, tomorrow is Wednesday. I don't know when I'm doing it Wednesday. Can't remember. Yeah. But it's on your agenda. I think tomorrow is 4 o'clock, maybe. But you'll have to look at the kiosk. They say this is supposed to help people by having them all different times that you can choose in that. But sometimes I just get crazy. What's happening? So, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You were great. And we'll hopefully see you tomorrow. If not, go wherever you are. But remember to tell stories.